You try to get a meal on Sunday, or you just lunch?
Pick all day.
No, we get a meal. We get one meal. And then, Sunday is usually the day that I am totally and utterly exhausted. And I try to do nothing.
And I got three papers to read.
Yeah, we get all the papers.
So I read the papers.
You have, pardon me, Phil, you have Saturday and Sunday off. But Saturday's an awful busy day.
Shopping.
Yeah.
Errands, running, picking.
Well, you know, Mama, after this week, I do the shopping again. Do you take turns?
She's been kind of tough with her, with her bum leg.
Yeah.
I was doing, actually, most of the shopping before this leg came off. Just to... went and did it. That's how our meals are got. If I get home and start, the meal's on the table. Otherwise, we both get it, but she gets it. How do you manage to break your leg, anyway?
Well, that's a good deal of skill, Julian.
I would imagine so.
Quite a long time to get smart enough to know how to do that.
I mean, the arms and legs, I'd say you really had yours.
I'm just saying, this is kind of interesting. What were you saying? Go ahead and talk now.
This blob of jelly is marvelous. Kara, this is the most marvelous blob of jelly. It came in a Christmas box from Florida.
I'll try that later.
Wonderful. I've never eaten finer, as a matter of fact. Have you, Julian?
No.
I've written and thanked you for the box, incidentally. I took care of that. Right on schedule.
Well, I must have some thank you.
That's real eavesdropping.
Why is he springing that around the corner again?
Did you have to remember Pauline too, or did you just settle with
Mom? The daycare that Laura Halsey found and gave us a decent gift. That was lovely.
After all these years?
Laura Halsey. She always sends us yard goods, you know.
I know, is she sick?
No, it was wonderful, but they come in old beat up wrapping paper tied with a string, and you open it up and you'll find exquisite cloth and the oddest blanks and fabrics and colors you could ever hope to find. This has come ever since I was a baby, and most of my swell looking clothes have been made out of her stuff. Years later, she find the use. So this time she sent nylons and a scarf and gloves.
Really?
Brown gloves and a beautiful French silk scarf.
Well, maybe the fabric shops in the East are shut down and you just don't know it yet. Maybe this is your warning.
I don't understand.
Well, I think, see, she finally saw me.
Oh.
Which was the telephone in 54, she finally saw me.
Did she come to Chicago?
No, I was in Washington.
Oh. Is Laura living in Washington?
I met that coffee.
Laura is living in Washington, and I think this is the year that she's 65.
Oh, really?
And her division was moved out of Washington into Atlanta, Georgia. You know, she was with public health.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a note from her last spring, terribly concerned, because the move was impending and she was worried about it, and she just would not live in Atlanta, Georgia. That's all there was to that. So maybe she was just going to have to retire.
You want me to throw that out?
She wouldn't contemplate living in Atlanta?
Mm-mm. You're kidding, huh?
No. Now she was faced with a horrible prospect. Henry got her husband, a doctor up in northern Minnesota, was killed in an automobile accident.
I didn't know Henry had a daughter.
Three of them.
I didn't know that.
His wife's still living, his first wife's still living, very bitter.
I didn't know that.
Didn't I ever send you any letter? I think it was Mary Jane. Mary Jane has never met Laura. And I told her so many Laura tales, and Carson and Lucille and everybody. So she said, you know, Laura still seems to me as if you make her up. So I got this one letter from Laura that I just put it in an envelope and sent it to Mary Jane. She wrote back immediately, "Forgive me, Lucille, for ever doubting you." This letter from Laura was a blow-by-blow account, all in one stream, without pausing for a period, punctuation, a paragraph, went on for pages and pages and pages, just streams and streams, just a stream of consciousness thing, where Henry's three daughters had come to visit them in Washington, and Laura had never seen them before. Finally, at long last, they came to Washington to visit Papa and Laura. And Henry, Laura had gotten out of, you know, Henry had his mama up there in that mm-hmm. little town, you know, all mm-hmm. those years. She lived to be 190 years old. Henry was there every week making his call. Nobody had been in the house, inside the house except Henry for 50 years. And Laura, as soon as the old lady died, Laura went up there and just raided it, you know, and took all the pieces that she wanted out of there. And then the daughters came to visit and they saw Grandma's. This and Grandma's house. They took a tour of the house, looking accusingly at Papa, you know, about all of these things that were Grandma's and that they had so long so loved and that Mama had decided she was going to have, you know, and they'd wonder where they'd gone. But Laura was very frantic about this visit, and it showed in the letter. When she told me last week last spring that Henry's daughter's husband had died, and they had just built, before the man was killed in an accident, one of these very expensive, you know, Powell-type houses, mm-hmm. the coming doctor in the community, and of course wasn't paid for it. So here was the widow, squirreled up there in northern Minnesota in that elegant home, which was still unpaid for, and Henry was thinking how nice it would be for Laura and he to retire there and live with them. You see, and help.
Oh, that's
help for this financial problem. And Laura just flatly says, no, that will not be ever. And Henry was determined. So I had this letter saying that she had finally persuaded Henry that he could go and live in Minnesota if he wanted to. But that as for herself, she was going to buy some property in New York City, right down on Fifth Avenue, preferably. Maybe an apartment building, where they could rent out and get income from the building, and there was going to be her home and no other place. That there's where she was going to invest money in property. Then I had a letter from her. Oh, I finally wrote to her and told her that Walt and I were getting a divorce and that I wanted very much to know whether or not we still owed them any money. So I heard from her immediately.
Immediately?
Yeah. And I said that no, we owed them no money. That assurance came immediately. And then she said that the office, her office had moved to Atlanta, Georgia, as she had mentioned before, that she was perfectly certain that she would never be able to. She wouldn't go to Atlanta. She was perfectly certain that she wouldn't be able to get a job because of age. But much to her surprise, she is still in Washington, head of some new division, and is doing all of the writing and the editorial work on, and she listed a half a page of just owl diseases.
And the preoccupation of syphilis in the years.
No, she's got all the fowl diseases now.
How old is Laura?
65.
So she's passed. Passed. I don't know. I think she held on. I've never been sure of Laura's age, and I think Henry told me quite a while ago that she was due for retirement, and she may have had one of these extensions. You know, she's either 65 or 67.
Well, that means when you and I first knew Laura years ago, she was younger than I am now.
Of course, yeah. Well, I remember Laura as a very handsome, very beautiful woman. You know.
Yeah. Well, she gave
very, very arresting woman. And crazy as hell.
Yeah.
You know how she.
Real mad.
Oh, just she just was absolutely wild. I guess she always was that way.
Yeah, always had been. Mm-hmm. But how in the world do you suppose through these years she's kept to?
I don't know.
These jobs.
With all the trouble?
Yeah.
I don't know how she's weathered that one.
She's thinking faster than the other.
That's right. And she She has this quality, which I've talked about so much, and with all of her impatience and with all of her nonsense, there's a real hardcore of reality right smack down underneath her, and she knows a holding operation is the most important thing in life, because she knows they die off. She's sitting here looking at me. She'd say, always remember that they die off, and if you're there,
you'll get it.
Yeah. Because they do die off. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of accidents. People are killed in the street every day.
They do die off.
Well, of course, I think of Laura as one of these perennially young people.
No, I guess she will always
be. And she'll always be young. And there's.
I told you, didn't I, about the time that Henry went to the hospital to have this very serious operation?
Yes, yes.
That is an incredible story. You and I would hear it. I would love it, and I'd listen to hear it again.
Her husband Henry had a very bad heart attack, and they thought he was going to die. Laura is a career woman in Washington. And finally, Henry had to have an operation, and it was terribly serious. And of course, she wouldn't tell anybody in the office because she didn't want anybody to ask her how he was. So instead of going into the office that day, she went immediately to the hospital. She got there and found out that Henry was up in surgery, and so she waited until he came down. And when he came down, she went into the room and took a look at him. And of course, he had taken his false teeth out, you know. And he was under ether, and she'd never seen anybody like this. And of course, he was all purple in the face, and his face had fallen in, and she thought he was dying for sure. She couldn't stand that. So she looked around and saw a wheelchair that some nurse had parked in the hall. And so she thought, well, if I can just get there, I'll be all right. And she finally, staggering, and a nurse saw her and came and supported her and sat her down in this wheelchair and asked if she could get her anything. And Laura said, coffee. That's what she had to have, coffee. She'd be all right if she had some coffee. That's the answer to everything. You know, just a cup of coffee. But the nurse went and got her some coffee, and she drank the coffee. And then how did this thing go? She decided she'd have to go to work. And she got up, and she didn't have any legs. Her legs had disappeared completely, and she started to cry. Because she couldn't stand up because she didn't have any legs. And she cried and cried and cried, and pretty soon the nurses and the doctors and everybody in the hospital came running. And what in the world was the matter? And she said, well, I haven't got any legs. Well, of course, they looked down, and obviously she had some legs. And so she said, well, she tried to stand up, and she didn't have any legs. And so she cried and cried some more. And then the doctor said, she's drunk. And the nurse said, well, I only put brandy in her coffee, a little bit of brandy in her coffee. And Laura, of course, can't stand liquor. And she really was. She was drunk from this tablespoon of brandy. So and she was carrying on like a regal drunk out there in this corridor.
No legs.
So they decided, no legs. So they decided that she better sleep it off. And they looked around for a room. And there was a man, an ambulatory patient, who was ready to go home that day. And he had dressed and gone out to the solarium or something, and his room was all made up, and so they put her in there on his bed, and she fell asleep. And the man came into the room, and of course, and found her in the bed, and there was a little commotion about that, so she decided that that was terribly embarrassing. So she looked at her watch, and it was so late, and my goodness, she was late for work, so she went to work. And she worked all day, and she went home, and she made dinner, and she thought, why in the world doesn't Henry get home here in time for dinner? And then she realized that Henry was in the hospital dying of an operation. I've forgotten all about it.
Laura.
Yeah, Laura. This is typical.
I'll never forget our first encounter with Laura. She took us home that night, you know.
Yeah, that was one of the most terrible ride we ever had.
I always drive just right in the middle of the road because there's so much snow on each side, and she went right down the cars, means dodging this way and that way. When we came to the bridge, I didn't think we'd make it. And here was the cliffs, you know, a 250-foot drop in the Mississippi. And she aimed sort of at it, you know, and I thought, my God, that aim is going to take us right over into the river.
Julian,
somehow,
at
the last minute, I mean, she got on the bridge,
Laura, I'd rather learn it to you.
Well, tell Juliana about the time that the surveyors were out in the
street. This is what I want to learn. When she first learned to drive, she was working as a social worker for the county in Minneapolis in the big old building there. And they had built right off the street a driveway that went down underneath to the sheriff's quarters during the time they used horses. So it was real narrow and twisty. And of course, Laura had to drive the county car in order to get around and do her business. And she was never very good at driving. Never has been very good at driving, and she must have been terrible when she started. And for her to negotiate this turn and this wind down there, of course, was something that they used to all through the courthouse alert everybody. Oh, she's coming, and everybody would fly, and get behind the tables and lock the doors, and everything else until it came to a stop and they knew that everything was safe. Well, one day she came a whooping down there and mad as could be and screaming for the sheriff. And she said, "It certainly is just terrible. Now, I know I'm not a real good driver, but I'll tell you that I wouldn't have any trouble driving if they didn't have all these things cluttering up the streets. And I think if you're the sheriff of this, I don't see why the sheriff is sitting around here in this office and all these things going on out in the street. And I don't think it's right, because there is nobody who can drive down the street when the surveyors are standing right out there in the middle of the street. And where in the world are the cars going to go? I saw their cars going all right." And she said, "And here was that surveyor standing there, and there wasn't a single sign that said that you couldn't." And she said, "And I just gave him a piece of my mind." She said, "Having that surveyor right out there in the middle of the street." And they said, "Surveyor?" And she said, "Well, yes, he's right out there in front of the bank." And, well, they knew there'd been no permit for surveying out there, so they went out and looked. Here's a guy with a machine gun. They're pulling up the bank robbers. And he's giving him a piece of her mind, believe me, cluttering up the street with all those surveying instruments.
And here he had a machine gun on a tripod.
On a tripod, and was covering the whole street with it.
She was just giving him hell.
She gave him a piece of her mind. And went and told the sheriff on him, too.
Well, that's more.
That is the big First National Bank robbery.
Yeah, that was a terrific one, too. I don't know, $1 million or something.
Yeah. I'll bet you that guy was so unnerved. He never went out on another job.
Not in Minneapolis, but more at large.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, I'll never forget.
That was funny, because they used to, really, I've heard many people say this, that they used to have scouts watching out the window, and they'd say, "Here she comes!" And the whole way through the building, they repeat, "Here she comes, here she comes."
She didn't know how to stop the car, did she?
No, she didn't know how to stop.
She let it go
and coast into a curb or something that would stop it. You see her in the side of a building or something, because she didn't know how to get stuck.
So you know how we felt when we started out? She said, "I always drive right in the middle of the street. There's so much snow on each side. Your streetcars coming in over." At that time, there were streetcars.
Oh, boy. She sounds like a character.
Oh, she is.
She is a character.
Oh, dear.
I gave him a piece of my mind. What are you doing, sitting around here? Yeah.
Juliana is old enough now to love one of our very favorite stories about the premature infant.
Oh, yeah.
Which one is
that? That's one of our favorites.
Oh, that's the one. Don't you remember the premature that went home on the streetcar?
Oh.
Have you heard it?
Let me in the hospital.
That'll be funny.
Yeah. When I was in nurse's training, I worked in the premature infant department, and that's what I specialized in, was in care of premature infants. And we had, this was in Minneapolis Hospital, and we had a very, very fashionable and socially prominent family in St. Paul that had had one of these weddings that all over the pages of the newspaper about 6 months previous to this. And there never had been such coverage of a wedding as when the scions of these two families amalgamated their fortunes. And she came over to our hospital in Minneapolis to have her baby, which was premature. As you can see, it must have been, you see, because it was just six months since they had
been married.
So, of course, she had this premature infant. And they had daily bulletins in the newspaper, you know, about how the mother and the baby were doing. And all was going along as well as could be expected. Mm-hmm. But finally, at the end of 10 days, why, the mama left the hospital, but of course they were unable to take the baby because the premature infants are left in special incubators and things, you see,
sure.
Until they get well done enough, you know, to go out. Well, we had a very busy premature infant nursery at that time. Well, in fact, all the incubators and all the beds were filled. And we used to get a little bit annoyed because this particular premature infant soon became too big to lie in the regular baby crib, you see. We had the infant crib because he weighed 8 pounds when he was born. This premature. It was an 8-pound premature. And finally he grew out of this little infant's crib and we had to put in a little bit larger crib. And of course that took up an awful lot of space because all these incubators were lined up and here was this great big thing. And of course the nurses began to take real delight in this premature. They just loved this premature. And all day and all night long, they were stuffing him full of food. Rock him and feed him and play with him and stuff. And he never lost an ounce. All babies lose, you know, something. Never lost an ounce. He began pound by pound getting bigger and lustier, stronger, you know. And these bulletins in the paper about this premature is about ready to come out of the incubator and soon he'll be strong enough, you know, to be taken home. The grandparents are so anxious, you know, to be able to see this child, but of course it's impossible because in the premature department nobody can see the babies. It's too dangerous. And all of these friends were anxiously waiting the premature. Oh! And so, as I say, it was just growing and growing and growing. And finally, I said to the doctor who was in charge of this baby, I said, now listen, we've got to do something about this baby because we're going to have to get a junior size crib in here pretty soon, and we haven't got room for him, you know. You've got to get rid of this baby somehow. I said, something has to be done about this baby. So he went to the telephone and he called up. He finally called up the father and said, listen, he said, either you come over and get your premature now and bring him home, or I'm going to give him a car token and a pair of knickerbockers and send him home.
That has been one of our favorite stories.
The premature.
Send him home on the streetcar.
Oh, Dallas. Sounds logical.
I wondered what happened to that boy.
My, what, 25, 30 yeah. years old now?
Yeah, he must be.
Probably has a premature of his own.
Yeah, his own premature now. Yeah. My.
Oh, I've had some wild ones with Laura, though. My goodness. You know, when we get together, it's just like telling, particularly if we have a new audience, you know, new friends of hers, but it's like a rosary, you know. I forget them. I forget these things. But she says, well, tell about, you know, and then she, pulling the beads down of her rosary, one after the other, you know, well, tell about, and then I remember.
Well, of course, I mean, your people-minded stories. I mean.
Well, I'll never forget driving around Minneapolis for a year with Angus's ashes in the back seat. They're coming around the corner.
Not Angus. Sophus. Angus is Mary Jane.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Sophus.
So who are all these dogs that are coming up to call on us today, Julian? There's been three now. Mm-hmm. There he goes.
That's Wimpy.
Oh, the funniest thing happened one day about 2 months ago, Lucille. We went up to deliver some mail at Margie's house, and Russell got out of the car and left the car door open, which he rarely does. Well, I walked around the car and walked in the house, and I was sitting there daydreaming, waiting for him to come out, and all of a sudden, to the side of that door came this enormous dog, the biggest thing I ever seen.
It was an Irish setter.
Great big Irish setter.
Is.
It just went right through the car door and came over and sat down on my lap and said, hey, kiss my shoulder.
Well, it was bigger than the steel. It was a great monster.
Its name is Susie, and it's Christner's dog.
It's a beautiful dog.
And it keeps me company when I walk in.
Can you imagine daydreaming in the car, and all of a sudden this great monster in on your lap?
Well, he didn't get out of the car. I had to talk to him. I pulled, you know, and I pulled at him, and he's
laughing.
He was just going to stay right there.
And that good neighbor calling, Gertrude Hazel's calling the kitchen about it 2 months ago, it struck me as funny. I left it in. I got a big kick out of it. I don't suppose anyone else saw. They were running cars and there was someone down south who was in bed as a result of having a mule jump in the car on her.
Oh, mule.
I left it in just the way it was written. Mule jumped in.
Julie and I came home with a funny joke the other day. One of the few dog stories that I found was funny. You tell that one, Julie.
Which one?
All about the dogs. The little kindergarten kid that came in. Talked to the well, I thought that was funny.
It is funny.
Oh, it's terribly funny.
Oh, dear. This is bestowed upon me by one of our dear freshman boys. We tell jokes like mad over at that school, and teachers get mad at us, but we don't care. Well, there were this little kindergartner, and there were these two dogs out on the playground, and the little kindergartner, but everything's a mystery to him. He just doesn't understand about anything, and so he goes and looks at his teacher, and he says, "Is there such thing as a flat dog?"
Flat dog.
And the teacher says, "No, I don't believe so. Why do you ask?" And he said, "Well, how come one dog's pumping the other one up?" You mean this really?
I think that's funny. I think that's a
we laughed until we cried until we came home with that.
Flat dog.
Oh, dear.
Well, in fact, the only funny jokes I've heard have been the jokes that Julian comes home
from school.
Yeah, because the other ones I hear are in the businessmen. You can imagine how stale and dull they are. Yeah. And they're all just either just plain
Julian,
obnoxious.
Tell Lucille about your deaf English teacher, Miss Reese. Oh, this is one of my
she's heard it, I'm sure.
Oh, well, Kira probably hasn't.
Bob Powell Jr.?
No.
This is in the 8th grade.
Oh,
Kira, you'll have to hear this because this is terribly funny.
What about the restroom pass? She had so many.
Mm-hmm. The restroom pad.
Well, in 7th grade, we can't go anywhere. You can't get permission. You have to get these little passes. They have to be okayed by the principal. You have to go through so much tape to go down the hall and get a drink of water that you'd... By the time you get it, the classes are over. So Bob Powell Jr. wanted to get the restroom pass, and so he went up, and we have a very deaf English teacher in 7th grade. And he said, "May I have the restroom pass, please?" And she looks at him, says, "Oh, well, it doesn't make that much difference. Just put it up on the desk."
The
class heard it, and everyone was laughing so hard.
Doesn't matter, just put it on.
Put it on the desk.
See, I'd forgotten we had passes.
That Rob and Jelly just wonderful, Kira.
Yeah.
That came from Florida, incidentally.
Gee, that's funny. Use a plate, will you, or something, because let's not crumb, you know.
We have a new vacuum. So
well, I know, but who wants to listen to that?
They can hardly wait for it to go.
Who wants to listen to that?
See, we got a real nice one, the kind that rolls. You just run up and downstairs.
You know, that's the kind I wanted, and I had set my heart upon it. Oh, I'm such a damn fool. And Selma just determined that we were going to get one from the store in Louisville.
Oh, so you got it cheap.
So I got it cheap, about $2 less, and not the kind I wanted.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And it was so much trouble to bring it up here, that I couldn't.
Yeah.
So I never did get the vacuum cleaner that I wanted.
Well, I'm going to show you this.
Because it won't.
Well, we just replaced one we'd had 12 years.
Yeah. Well, I'm always unhappy about it because I'd put up with a nasty old one for a long time too, and I was so glad of the opportunity to really get one that I wanted.
This is brand new. I just bought it day before yesterday.
That's the one I want.
See?
No, that's what I told you. I know all about that one. I've looked at it many times, Rob.
Do you know how much it cost? $61.
Yeah, I know, which is about just a few dollars.
That's right.
Well, I could have gotten one for $49.50 on a sale at that time. It would turn in my old one and got it for $49.50, and I think I paid $47 or $45 for the one they brought up.
We didn't turn our old one in. We took it out to the office and we're using it to clean up the machines.
But
I still think the corporation has to buy that.
Yeah, we'll have to write a check. Well, of course, all I have to do is write a check, you see. Mm-hmm. And it's perfectly legitimate.
Sure.
It becomes office equipment then.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think we ought to charge, $55 or $65? I think we ought to pay for this one out of the corporation. That's the one.
You know, Lucille's taking me so long. You know, I had so many, many, many years of being conditioned in that business. It's taken, in fact, I can't relax in it yet. I have great difficulty. And I remember that when we got ready to entertain the office staff, well, now that's all business expense, you know, after all. And you know that I just suffered so when we did that, and I told Russell the reason was, I knew, when we had Sidney Finch here that time, oh God, we went all out to entertain them, you know, had two big meals and all, and we presented a bill for $25 to the company, which really didn't cover it. Some of it came out of our own pockets.
I'm sure you don't.
They were heavy drinkers.
We don't do that on $25.
They were heavy drinkers, and two big meals, no liquor. But you know, I said to Russell, you know, I could hardly present that bill. I almost, even though we couldn't do it, I almost didn't do it, present it, because I just felt so nervous. So you see, that carryover is very difficult for me.
Well, I'll tell you the difference is, Lucille, that I have written so many more of the checks now. You see,
I
have become partner. I mean, now, if I write
just
a check for $1,500, I mean, it's just $1,500. That's it. I mean, when I first started writing those checks, I mean, I was clever. I got so nervous I could hardly write. And of course, we have a machine to write the check itself, you see. But it was almost more than I could bear. Now I've gotten to the place where I could write, like yesterday afternoon, I mean, $825 worth of checks, I mean, in advance, payments for stock, so, et cetera. And think nothing of it. And of course, I went completely to pieces on the adding machine, because I couldn't believe that we still would have as much money left in the bank.
I'm going to get our bonds out of pocket.
It's just fantastic. What, dear?
I'm going to get our bonds out of pocket.
Those don't interest me at all. I'm the most foolish kind of nonsense I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, God, I hate to pay $186 interest twice a year.
Well, honey, we don't pay that, because we have all the coupons, you see, that automatically take care of over half of it.
Well, we can't clip them until they're out.
Well, what I'd like to do is redeem the bonds, borrow the money, redeem the bonds, and write them off. And then start, we do have bonds in our vault, say,
one
thing. Yeah. We have more than that, dear. I mean, there's the one, and there's...
No, put the other two up last summer.
Yeah, but they're not put in to the maximum.
I beg your pardon.
Anyway, you feel better when you have bonds.
Yeah, and they're in Hawk. Yeah. We can't do anything with them. I like to get to redeem them.
Of course, they're in Hawk.
I mean, use them as a cushion in case you need it.
Well, believe me, the whole economy is a paper economy, you know.
You know, I have to laugh so about my father. He always said his salary off.